This is episode 8 of the Software Freedom Law Show. Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Software Freedom Law Show. I'm Karen Sandler, and I'm here with Bradley Kuhn.
And today we're not interviewing a guest. It's just going to be the two of us having a discussion that we mentioned briefly when, I guess, two episodes ago when we were talking about various issues related to licenses, when we were talking about the exceptions. We said, well, we should have a show where we just talk about the process of selecting a license for your project.
So in this episode, we're going to talk a little bit more about some of the issues of selecting licenses. God, I'm such a lawyer. We start talking about it, and I'm suddenly like, this should not be construed as legal advice. If you are choosing a license, be sure to evaluate every issue with your lawyer.
Okay, but now that we've had the lawyer disclaimer. Yeah, one of the things that became clear as we were prepping for the show is that the number of issues you actually have to be worried about in selecting a license, mm-hmm. as far as policy questions, are not as extensive as people tend to think. I think a lot of people feel there's this giant list of policy questions, and if you can't figure out what policy you want for every last thing, you're going to have a hard time picking a license. And I actually don't think that's true, because there's only a few really big policy questions in license selection.
And I think that some of the details have already been worked out. I mean, I think this is one of the advantages to having a few really popular and widely used licenses, is that a lot of that heavy lifting has been done. So you can really focus on just a few policy issues. I guess one of the key ones is, of course, copyleft, and mm-hmm. whether to have it or whether not to have it, and whether to have a permissive license.
Yeah, and it's interesting, because there was sort of this weird period of time in the late 1990s where the advocacy of getting companies to adopt open source and free software ended up through a series of just weird things that happened, causing companies to write a lot of their own licenses. And so we have mm-hmm. this problem that's often called license proliferation, where companies wrote very similar licenses to each other that were only slightly different. And I think that's led to the fundamental confusion and getting people to believe there's all mm-hmm. these questions, because there exist so many licenses that are considered either open source or free software or both, and they don't know how to select among those. But the fact is, as you said, you just have to answer these few questions, and the first one being this issue of whether or not you want copyleft.
Yeah, actually, I think that we're sort of coming out on the other end of license proliferation now, where I think so many people recognize that having so many licenses that are different in tiny ways that people can't understand is such a bad thing, that that really only a small set of licenses have been identified as the ones that most people will go to.
To be honest, it's easy for us to say that, because we were involved in the creation of one of the more popular ones, so it's easier for us to say that. I think there is a segment in the community that feels that some of these licenses are getting ignored. I don't personally agree with them, but some people do feel that way, and we should at least give them.
No, I think that's right, and I think we can evaluate, you know, certain, I guess I would call them features of certain mm-hmm. licenses, and see if it's worth, you know, if there's something there that we're missing in other licenses. For sure. But I guess I keep hearing about, about how unpopular it is to choose a license that's not one of the more popular. And when I say one of the more popular licenses, I guess I'm saying that because I looked at the OSI list earlier, and they actually call them popular licenses without mm-hmm. Necessarily making a judgment on their, you know, on whether they should be used or not used. But
yeah, I mean, it's been a tough thing, you know, sort of community-wide with these policy questions, because, you know, the Free Software Foundation, who was the first to maintain a license list, I actually was the originator of that FSF license list many, many years ago, that list has sort of been very fact-based about FSF's FSF's evaluation. So they say either it's a free software license or it's not, either it's mm-hmm. GPL compatible mm-hmm. or not. And they don't really make a recommendation one way or another. They recommend their own licenses that they publish, of course, but beyond that, they're not.
I think actually, if you take a look at the list, I think there are certain circumstances where, I think in quite a few places on that list, there are recommendations please avoid this license, or don't use this license for anything other than X or Y.
Agreed. That's true. But I think that boils down to one single recommendation that the FSF is making, which is they encourage you to use a GPL compatible free software license. Mm-hmm. And pretty much that's their main encouragement. And while there are these little things where they say, well, if you're working on a project that's integrating with this other stuff, then maybe you would use this. They're basically saying, well, we're sort of making a small exception to that general recommendation. But I think all their recommendations are sort of focused around GPL compatibility and being free software.
Which brings us to our, to the topic that we were hoping to focus on in this mm-hmm. segment, which is, copyleft versus a more permissive license. And I think what it boils down to, and the FSF is the perfect example of this, is different ideas of freedom and, mm-hmm. and how best to accomplish that.
Right. And then there's this classic thing of the folks who prefer what we tend to call the permissive licenses, which some people just call the BSD licenses. The problem with that is that there's so many different BSD licenses that nobody really knows what you mean when you say BSD. Mm-hmm. So we tend to say permissive.
And it's the same problem if you say MIT style.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the funny thing is MIT has about 30 different licenses they've used for software mm-hmm. over the years. And when people say the MIT license, they actually mean a very specific one, which is mm-hmm. very similar to the other permissive licenses that are out there.
Right.
So that's why you'll hear us in this venue and pretty much every venue we speak in saying this permissive licenses so that we don't get confused about what the terms actually mean from these various different licenses.
And I think we can never say this enough, actually, that SFLC is license agnostic. We believe that that different licenses are appropriate in different situations. And while we each have our individual views about what licenses we prefer.
Like a Faro, for example.
and other licenses, we all have our own views.
I prefer Faro.
Yeah, well, you're one of the authors of a Faro.
I know.
So it's no surprise.
Yeah, indeed.
And I like a Faro license, too, for certain circumstances. So it really depends on...
But I'm involved enough with licenses that I feel it really is a personal decision almost mm-hmm. of the project to decide what kind of community they're creating, who they're associating themselves with, and that sort of thing. And as we keep hinting at, that first decision is the copyleft versus non-copyleft space. This comes down to the question, I think, between using the FSF licenses, which are primarily the copyright mm-hmm. licenses, or not using them. And there's plenty of reasons. As you mentioned, the community of folks who choose the permissive licenses actually believe that their licenses are more free mm-hmm. Because they give more permissions. Now, being myself on the copyleft side, which is just how mm-hmm. I am, I make a distinction between giving more permissions and giving more freedom. But I see the point that people say that if you want to give people the permission to do anything they want, if you believe that's sort of the maximum way to advance your software project and give them, in your mind, freedom, then mm-hmm. you should choose that way.
Yeah, I mean, because then basically what you're doing is you're not adding any restrictions because mm-hmm. the copyleft mm-hmm. component of the GPL is, it is a restriction, even though, mm-hmm. it, people say it's forever free.
Yeah. Stallman likes to call it requirements, not restrictions, but that's merely just...
No, that's right. Yeah. I mean, but what I'm saying is from the permissive perspective, mm-hmm. I you'd often hear it mm-hmm. described as a restriction, mm-hmm. but I agree, and there are different tools to accomplish different purposes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so that's really, and the interesting thing when I talk about copyleft versus non-copyleft is. The policy question isn't to say whether or not your community wants to see the software always remain free and open. What it's actually saying is, what tool are you going to use to encourage that? Most people in the various BSD communities, for example, really strongly prefer and mm-hmm. strongly advocate to get changes back into the main mm-hmm. line, to get them under their license, and so forth. But their decision-making process is they want to use social environment and advocacy as their primary tool to get things released under free software licenses. The GPL mm-hmm. uses those tools too, but they add another one, which is a legal requirement. Mm-hmm. So it's really a question of whether or not you want to use the legal requirement to ensure that something's free software or not. That's really the decision, I think, between copyleft and non-copyleft.
That's interesting. So you mean, right, so it's basically codifying in the license an advocacy position, which is definitely the case.
Right. Whether I mean, basically, it's choosing between anarchy and law in some way. Like, again, I'm a fan of anarchy, right? You know, I was a punk kid, you know. So
I don't think it's fair to describe permissive licensing as anarchy.
Yeah, it's probably
I really don't think so. I mean, those are licenses with requirements, and they're part of products that are appropriately structured and.
You're right.
I disagree.
Yeah, you're right. I admit that saying it's anarchy is an exaggeration, but it's a compliment because I like it.
But our listeners might not know that.
I just said that. I just said I used to be a punk and was into this thing when I was a teenager. So it's a compliment for sure. But you know, having done so much, you know, GPL enforcement and seeing, you know, how copyleft can work to encourage freedom, that puts me on that side as a personal matter of my personal opinion. But that's really the question you're asking. What do you want the license to be doing for you? Do you want it just to define how software gets out in the world and not much more than that, or do you want it to define how ongoing, when people make derivative works, what are the requirements placed on them to continue participating, and how do you structure that participation? Mm-hmm. So I think that's a question you ask yourself when you think about copyleft versus non-copyleft. What other questions do you think come up in that area of?
Oh, you know, I mean, I think that's really the key one. I think the other is, you know, which community or what kinds of community do you want to attract to your project? Because people have very strong ideas about which licenses they would like feel comfortable contributing under, and right. You will exclude or include a whole group of people based on what you select.
Right. So, for example, if you're writing an application for OpenBSD to run using PF, which is their packet filtering, IP tables is the equivalent in the Linux world, you wouldn't want to pick the GPL more than likely, because your goal is to get your software adopted because you're using PF, packet filtering, which only exists on the BSDs. You want that community to adopt it, and they're not mm-hmm. likely to quickly adopt a GPL program. So that's an example where you have a community that you want to be the users of your software, and they already have personal opinions about what license they prefer, so you want to go with the license that they tend to prefer.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense to choose a license that's going to exclude the people that, or rather alienate mm-hmm. people that you're... Mm-hmm. You're most importantly trying to attract.
Yeah, I mean, not that the BSD community doesn't use some GPL stuff; they use GCC mm-hmm. and so forth. Mm-hmm. But I think in a lot of the BSD community, they it's somewhat begrudging that they use GPL stuff. So if you really want to get into that community, you'd want to pick that a license like that rather than the GPL. By contrast, if you want your patches to go into GNU Emacs, well, you probably want to pick GPL v3 or later, because that's the license that GNU Emacs is under. And if your goal is you're writing Emacs Lisp to go in as a module for GNU Emacs, well, then you probably want to pick that.
On the other hand, if you want to distribute your work under a permissive license, then
yeah, if it was GPL compatible,
exactly. Well, I guess when we're saying permissive licenses, mm-hmm. we're talking about licenses that are GPL compatible.
Yeah, but on the other hand of that is that yes, you could.
How many hands do we have now?
Well, I'm just contrasting with what you just said specifically. That when you decide to contribute it back to GNU Emacs, even if you license it under some GPL compatible permissive license, the folks are going to pick it up in GNU Emacs, and they're going to make GPL v3 improvements to it. Mm-hmm. So even if your original work was licensed permissively under a GPL compatible license, if it's going into a project like GNU Emacs that's heavily GPL focused, it's going to end up having other people adding to it GPL changes.
And I think actually there's a lot of confusion about this and how it works and how to carry that out properly. And I think we're going to talk more about that in the next segment.
We should head down that road in the next segment. So once you've made this decision between copyleft versus non-copyleft, mm-hmm. Let's suppose you're chasing it down the copyleft side. And for sake of argument, let's call it a new project so we can put aside those other issues. So you have this new project and you've decided you want to do copyleft. Well, then you're left with a decision between weak versus strong copyleft, mm-hmm. as it's traditionally called. Those probably aren't the best words, but they're the traditional words mm-hmm, anyway. Mm-hmm. And of course, the GPL and AGPL are the strong copylefts, where every improvement, every change, every derivative work has to be licensed under terms compatible with the GPL.
And LGPL is the weaker copyleft, mm-hmm. and I think it was originally designed for libraries, right?
Well, it was designed
because
for,
I think of it as I know there's the people refer to it
as
the
RMS
as the library GPL, but I know that it's the lesser GPL.
It's the lesser
because
GPL
because it's a lesser copyleft.
Yeah. And it was designed for a specific library. The original LGPL program was glibc because there was a decision made that getting a strong copylefted library adopted would be very, very difficult, mm-hmm. and users would have, from the point of view of the FSF's history, more freedom if at least their library was free, even if their applications were not.
So it's another example of advocacy through licensing.
Right, and making a decision to make it a weaker copyleft, not using the full legal tools available, and weakening your sort of legal standing as far as how many mm-hmm. derivative works end up being under your license, in an effort to try and get adoption and interest.
I think that RMS is really smart about this, and, mm-hmm. and has always been, and it's very impressive how mm-hmm. now there's this this suite of licenses, actually, mm-hmm. that are great advocacy tools.
Right, and of course, there's another way we should mention to make weak copylefts, which we talked about two shows ago, which is you can write an exception that
right.
weakens your copyleft, and actually LGPL mm-hmm. V3 is just a set of exceptions to GPL. So there's a mm-hmm. whole big space of weak copylefts that you can draft exceptions for and build your space of where you want the weakness, how weak you want your copyleft and so forth. But it's really a question of the kind of adoption you want, and if you want to see proprietary applications using your library for whatever reason. You might have some reason that we can't even think of.
Mm-hmm.
If this certain proprietary community would start using this library, it would mean that there would be lots of whatevers in the world, and that would be a good thing for free software because more people would have that LGPL library. Or if you're trying to do some sort of orthogonal advocacy position, like glibc was trying to get GNU adopted.
Oh, right.
So the goal was to get the whole of GNU adopted, and by allowing proprietary applications on GNU,
right.
you got that done. So there's I mean, it's really sort of beyond the scope of the podcast to know what your goals are
mm-hmm.
for picking a weak copyleft. But you should think about, do I have goals that will be achieved by weakening my copyleft a little bit if I've chosen to generally be copylefted already?
Right. So you can think about that. Think about the community.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, there are all these considerations that you can keep in mind when you choose your license. And there are different licenses for each way along that spectrum.
Right. Now, suppose if you chose non-copyleft altogether. Well, then mm-hmm. you're in the space, you know, you have the various BSD licenses. There's two clause and three clause BSD are the ones that are generally recommended, which are relatively simple permissive licenses. There's the ISC license, which is
mm-hmm.
sort of a 1.5 clause BSD, if you will.
Right.
And there's licenses like the Apache license and so forth. And the key question you're asking yourself when you get there, I think, is whether or not you want a patent grant clause in your license.
Mm-hmm. And I think that that's actually, and I feel like every time we do these podcasts, we unearth new topics that would make great podcasts on their mm-hmm. own. And this is one of those situations mm-hmm. because, you know, I think to talk about this fully, we'd probably want to talk about explicit patent grants and implicit patent grants.
Mm-hmm.
And what that is that, you know, there are certain circumstances where even though you don't explicitly say, I grant you patent rights over my work, that you just by distributing the software are granting implied patent grants,
mm-hmm.
Which I think a lot of people don't necessarily consider.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But we're talking here about explicit patent grants in licenses, and I think you were talking about the Apache.
Yeah, I mean, from my point of view, you know, I've this is a personal opinion, but from watching all these licenses develop over the years, you know, when somebody comes to me and says, "Well, I'm not into copyleft," I say, "That's cool. You know, we disagree, but." You know, I'm not, I don't dislike people who dislike copyleft at all. And they say, well, what license should I select if I want a little bit more? I want to have an explicit patent grant. I don't just want to do an ISC license thing where there's not any, where the patent license, if it's there, it's only implicit. I say I usually recommend the Apache license because they've put a lot of work into it. They really
mm-hmm.
Have spent a lot of time thinking about that issue, and that was sort of for a period of time that was sort of their main issue they wanted to get done in their license was that patent grant. So I tend to recommend that if you want a non-copyleft, generally permissive license, but mm-hmm. you'd like to see an explicit patent grant. And so I think it's a really good choice when that ends up being your final decision about the kind of license you want.
And of course, if you are comfortable and want a strong copyleft, of course, the GPL has a strong patent
grant. We haven't said that explicitly, that there is a patent grant in GPL v3. Mm-hmm. And if you've gone the copyleft side, you're getting that patent grant anyway. Mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. then if you go to the permissive side, you have to think about, do I want to put this patent grant? And the funny thing is these are really the only issues in front of you, I think, when you do.
Are the major issues. Yeah, there's also, we were talking earlier that we see trademark issues coming up in these contexts, and I think we both agree that it's sort of a secondary issue, in part because trademarks can also be addressed outside of the actual license.
Yeah, I did misspeak a little bit by saying the only issues, but I think they're the fundamental ones. I worry sometimes that people stress too much over this decision, and because there are so many licenses, obviously it's getting better that license proliferation is starting to disappear, but there's I think a feeling that you have to understand all these different issues, and a lot of them are really minor compared to the ones we've discussed. You're really picking copyleft versus non-copyleft, and if you go the copyleft side, weak versus strong, and then over on the permissive side, you're saying, do I want a really permissive thing, or do I want to include an explicit patent grant? And it really covers all of the space that's out there as far as the big issues that you have to think about.
Yeah, and I think that you do want to stay focused on these simple questions, because I think when you start researching it, you find out, or you see a lot of the discussions generated by the legal community. And as we've talked about a lot on this podcast, lawyers really like to focus in on the edge cases and the places where things are likely to where things are interesting, I guess, which are not situations that we see necessarily that often. Mm-hmm. And I think that lawyers can often get distracted by the minutiae when really the things you want to consider are very simple.
It's funny, I was reading a poker book last night. People know I'm a fan of poker, and the beginning, it was a new book that I just got. And the beginning of the book, they say, every answer is it depends. But the problem is people talk too much about the case where it depends, and that's such a small case compared to all the others. So what they did in this book is they said anything where it depends is going to be a footnote, because so many times there is a generally right thing to do, a right way to make the decision, and the it depends case is much more minor than people realize. And because people like to debate things that are unclear, they tend to focus on the smaller spots where there is a debate, when they could actually just focus on the general question. And it's actually, there's not so many confusions and debates that have to happen when you're thinking more generally.
It's fun to think about those situations that may or may not happen.
But hackers don't like to have to go through this. I wrote a blog post a couple of months ago saying licensing is a decision people want to make in an hour and start their project and never have to revisit it. And I feel that a lot of disservice has been done to the hacker community by pushing so much licensing confusion on them, in some sense, of having all these licenses and having all these issues covered in different licenses, because it doesn't really serve their needs as much as giving them some simple questions to ask themselves and let them pick a license. I kind of feel like a lot of the licensing advocacy that's gone on is a little bit too much. And it's not other people I'm criticizing alone. I've done it myself. I've done a lot of licensing advocacy in my day, and there's probably been more of it than needed to be, to some extent.
I was just sort of quiet here because I was thinking about what Creative Commons has done, and that's, because I refer to the FSF as having a suite of licenses, but it's actually, it's a little bit different in that these licenses are very focused. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I guess I was wondering if there was some opportunity for...
A couple of people have written license selectors, little web applications that help you select the license and ask you a series of questions and take you through.
Right.
It's like playing
the
game.
Oh, I'd like to see those.
Yeah, it's like playing the game of Animal. You ever played that game?
No.
You never played the game? It's a classic little computer game where the computer asks you, you think of an animal and it asks you questions about the animal.
Oh, yeah, it's the 20 questions.
Yeah, it's like 20 questions, and then you teach it by it's sort of like your first most programmers' first experience in artificial intelligence, because it asks at the very end, if it gets it wrong, it says, give me a question I can ask people in the future so I can guess the animal better. And so there are these sort of things for picking a license. Do you want a copyleft? Do you not want a copy? Those kind of things. And then at the end, you get some license out. And those are, I think, somewhat useful, but I think generally they tend to try to cover the whole spectrum of licenses that are free and open source software when there may be no reason to pick some of them because they're so similar to others. And then the decision, when you have two licenses, for example, if you look at the Mozilla license and the Eclipse license, they're very, very similar. Yep. There's a couple of differences, but they're very similar. And ultimately, you're only going to pick between one or the other based on whether you're collaborating with Mozilla people or collaborating with Eclipse people. You know, and there's no real policy reason to pick one or the other. It's really a collaboration question.
Yeah, I mean, there are really good resources for looking at license overviews.
Yeah.
You know, we were talking about the FSF list before, and, you know.
And then there's the OSI list, and
We actually wrote a primer, which is an introduction to legal issues for free and open source software projects. And we have a whole section on copyright, and there's a section also on license selection. And we really don't talk about a lot of the different licenses. We really focus on just a few to give you an overview. Mm-hmm. So that might be a good place to start if you're interested.
Yeah, but don't feel, I think the last message I would leave hackers with is don't feel like you need to become an expert on licensing. I mean, that's, you know, I said in my blog recently that's down that path lies madness. You know, I think that it's our job at SFLC and places like FSF and OSI to be watching this stuff for you and trying to give you very easy ways of thinking about these things, because we don't want free software developers bogged down in debating licenses and so forth. I think it burns a lot of time when people could be off, you know, just coding.
That said, I do really want to encourage people to think carefully about what license they're choosing, because just earlier in the week I was talking with someone who felt like he had... I wouldn't say been duped, but he was misled about the implications of a license. He didn't really think about it too much. And because he was contributing to a specific project that was in its early stages of development, he adopted a particular license. I'd say didn't really fully understand its implications, and now later wishes he had chosen a different license. And the time for thinking about that is when you first start contributing to a project. Am I comfortable with this license? Or what license should I select that I will be comfortable with in the long run? So I agree with you that you don't want to get too bogged down in the details of licensing, but you really want to think about the basic ideas behind the license that you're choosing and make sure that you're comfortable with them.
Yeah, and you can almost never go wrong picking a license there's a big community behind and lots of code already under it. And it's on, basically, you know, I tell people, make sure it's an approved license on the OSI list, make sure it's a FSF approved license, and make sure it's a Debian DFSG.
Yeah, I was going to say we actually hadn't mentioned that earlier.
Those are the three places I think people should look. These days, I never am comfortable with a license that's not positively on all three of those lists, as positively an open source license as defined by OSI, positively a free software license as defined by FSF, and positively DFSG free as defined by Debian. Those are really the three entities that do a really good job vetting licenses. And of course you can ask us too, but we're telling you, hey, if they're on all three lists, you're probably in good shape.
Yeah, definitely. So
I think we want to wrap up this segment, and hopefully in the next segment we can talk a little bit more about what happens when you're contributing to a project already that already has an established license, and how you think about that. We'll have a bit of a debate. So we're gonna get ready and come back and have our little debate.
We'll be right back. You know, I don't know that we're actually going to have a debate.
Why not? I want to have a debate.
Because I think...
It's like in the Monty Python sketch where you're arguing whether or not this is an argument?
It's not an argument. No, I think... I mean, we actually, to fill our listeners in, this is... we had a heated conversation over chat, probably over IRC, about, I guess, a month ago, where we really... dug into it, and we stopped in the middle and said, "This is probably going to be a great podcast."
Yeah, and it stems from this. I mean, it started in some sense a long time ago when we did this work. You can read about it on our website with helping the Linux guys, the Linux Wireless team, get a clear method for taking. Keeping a device driver under the ISC license, even though there were people contributing to it in Linux, because they wanted to share it back with the BSD crowd, and it started this conversation about, you know, what what you should do when contributing to a project under a particular license. Mm-hmm. And I've always long felt that it's just downright rude to try to push a change on someone under a license that's not the license of their project. That you should just never do that. If you want to get involved in working on a project, yeah, even me as an AGPL hardcore copyleft advocate, if I'm contributing to an ISC licensed project, I'm going to get my changes back in ISC. They've picked their license. I've benefited so much from their code. I'll go along with them.
And I agree with you, but I think I think that only goes so far. And I think that I'm very sympathetic to people who want to contribute their changes, or rather, who don't feel comfortable having their code being used in certain ways. So
look, of anybody in the world, I mean, I do not want my code in proprietary software, right? I really don't want it in proprietary software, but there's a greater good to be served. And am I really going to, I mean, I guess if I were going to become a core developer on a project, I'd think differently. But if I've just got changes, you know.
I mean, you're not going to submit one patch and say, I mean, if you.
But some people do that. I think it's horrible.
I mean, I know of instances where people are doing that, but I agree that it's not the most considerate thing to take, to be using a project that is under a permissive license and then say, well, if you want this change that I made, you can use it, but you're going to have to use it only under a copyleft license, which is basically, in effect, useless to the original project because they're not going to change their whole license at that point. But at the same time, when you contribute under a permissive license, you know, you have to be aware that there can be a copyleft fork. I mean, that's...
Yeah, and that's true, and there have been cases where projects have become copylefted. Karen just dropped her coaster from her glass of water, but my computer beeped during the last segment, so I guess we're even. I really feel that it's important to keep the peace between the copyleft and non-copyleft space on this issue and lots of others. You know, I mean, I talk a lot about how Microsoft has worked very hard to fight free software. And one of the things they've always tried to do is drive that wedge between the copyleft and the permissive license communities. And I've seen, you know, at conferences, you know, years ago when Microsoft first started trying to do this, I saw people from various, like, Apache Project and so forth stand up and say, no, we're not going to say our friends in the copyleft world are no good just to make Microsoft happy. And I guess it was that moment that made me feel like, look, you know, the guys in the non-copyleft space and the permissive license space are our friends and are our colleagues and are working with us. We disagree on something, which is not necessarily a fundamental disagreement. We both want to advance free software. We both want to get more code out there to the world. And my feeling is I want to keep the peace. I want to respect their decisions. I want them to respect my decisions about this licensing. And I don't want to start bleeding across that line such that we have a copyleft versus non-copyleft war again.
And I agree with you. I agree with you. And I think that it's a polite and considerate way to behave. But I also think that you need to consider the implications of a license when you select it. Mm-hmm. And so if you choose to contribute under a permissive license, you have to be prepared for somebody to use that license in a more restricted way. You've given them the permission. You've explicitly given them the permission to do it. And so when it happens, you know, you've created that situation. I mean, you've given that permission, and it's very frustrating to see, for example, developers who are frustrated that that their work is incorporated into it for a copyleft work when in fact it had been incorporated in many proprietary works before then.
Right. So I agree with you that at times, you know, there are people in the permissive license community who. Or in the BSD communities, basically, who are harder on copyleft than they are on proprietary software. It bugs me too, to a certain extent. But the thing is, that just drives my point home further, which is, let's be as cooperative as possible about their licenses when we're modifying and improving their code, because that's the way to build the bridges between our communities. So if we harp on this fact of, oh, why do you give proprietary such more hard time why do you give copyleft such a harder time than you give the proprietary guys? And that's not always true. I mean, I think there are people in the BSD community who do give a hard time the proprietary guys.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, remember, their strategy is don't use the legal tools, use social tools to get people to release their code. So from their point of view, they have to use those social tools against GPL. And
this is why I was saying that I didn't think this was going to be that much of a debate, because I think we agree on that. And now I feel like, you know, in some ways you're pushing me to the other side, but I agree with you. So, but what I'm saying is that the flip side to that is that when you choose a permissive license, you have to really understand the implications of it.
Yeah, I agree with that.
You know, it's adopting a different mm-hmm. advocacy tool, mm-hmm. but at the same time, you are licensing your code under a certain mm-hmm. under a certain license, and you're granting permission for this to happen.
Yeah, but I mean, particularly for new contributors who are just coming into a project, I mean, you're there's a lot of goals there. It's not just the goal of choosing the right license for your personal beliefs. There's the goal of trying to join that community, and there's the goal mm-hmm. of trying to get your patch accepted. And you just create, I think, as a developer who's new to a project sending a patch in, you just create barriers for yourself. When you say, "Oh, I'm contributing to an ISC project, but I only want to do it under GPL because I'm a GPL fan," mm-hmm. I think it does a disservice when we aren't telling developers, "Look, you know, join the community you're contributing to, and try to at least for a little while you're contributing to that project, take on their values a little bit, you know, and be a chameleon in that sort of way, because it'll allow for more collaboration between various different groups. Look, we can't let that wedge come between copylefts and non-copylefts, because people who want to kill free software, who want to hurt free software, are going to use that against us if we have a wedge in our own community. We need to be united and say we differ on various things, but work together to the common good, which is making more open source and free software in the world.
And I completely agree with that. I do. I guess.
So then, why do you say it's okay for somebody to send a GPL patch to an ISC project?
Well,
it's not okay. You're being a jerk. Stop doing it. That's what I say. And I love copyleft, but if you send a GPL patch to an ISC project, you're just being a jerk.
Okay. I agree, but if you're contributing to the ISC project, so if you're on the other side and you've released your code under permissive license, then you know, don't complain when somebody incorporates it in a more, you know, in a differently licensed way, because you've granted that permission.
Wait, you're asking hackers not to complain at each other? Do you want a pony?
Maybe
too?
Maybe just don't complain to me.
Yeah, I don't think we're
going to... I do want a pony.
Well, I don't think we're going to get hackers to stop complaining to each other. That's not something we can do. But maybe we can get them to stop, you know, trying to over-influence licensing decisions on projects that they're new to.
You know, and also making, you know, accusations of different sorts.
Now you're just talking about F5K.
No, I'm actually not. I'm saying that it's these situations are built because of this tension.
Yeah.
And there's this misunderstanding, and I think it goes both ways. And I think it can be diffused from both directions, actually. Okay. And I think that's maybe what we're getting at here, is that I think if everybody understands each other a little bit more.
Everybody just has to hug each other more. And love. Peace.
Maybe that is the best way to end our podcast for this week.
Okay.
Or this 2 weeks.
This period. This fortnight.
Peace and love.
There it is.
Yeah, well, it was. Thank you for joining us.
I forgot one thing. We had an email question, Carol.
Oh, right.
We need to answer the email because it's the guy emailed us like 3 weeks ago, and had a question that we need to answer. And I had the odds. It's a really good question, actually. Yeah, I don't need the numbers.
It's not a legal question
because we worked the numbers out. Yes, somebody asked us because obviously there's a lot of people who love the Ogg Vorbis format as I do because mm-hmm. it's really developed out of our community, and everybody knows there is that the Fraunhofer patent floating around mm-hmm. on the MP3 stuff. And if you do encoding commercially, you need a commercial patent license to encode MP3s commercially, mm-hmm. and that's something our community wants to give freedom to both commercial and non-commercial users, and Ogg Vorbis is a way to do mm-hmm. that. Of course, we make the, you know, we're operating non-commercial, we make the stuff available under both Ogg and MP3 because we know there's people who do want the MP3, but this fellow asked us what is our percentage? You know, how many people are actually selecting Ogg? And we found out 75%. 75% of our listeners are using the Ogg Vorbis format as opposed to MP3, which
that's pretty great.
Is great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. So and we have about the other interesting statistic that we'll volunteers. We've got now about 1,000 people each episode downloading it, about that.
That's great.
Yeah, so we've...
So thank you for listening to us.
We don't know if they're listening.
That's true.
We don't know if there could be five of those thousand listening. Thank you for downloading us. Yes, 1,000 people. I actually have a, you know, because one of my other jobs here at the SFLC is doing various technology work, and I watch the graphs of the Tuesday flood we get of people downloading the podcast, and we stay right at 1.5 megabits all day, people downloading it. So it's good. We want people to download it. We hope you're listening too.
Well, thank you for downloading. But if you're hearing this, you're listening. So thank you.
And as always, we're a charity in the U.S. and you can donate on our website.
Softwarefreedom.org.
Softwarefreedom.org. And if you want to give us feedback and ask us questions, podcast@softwarefreedom.org.
Thanks for joining us. See you next time. The Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivative Works 3.0 United States License.